This is Andy.
And this is Matt.
And you're listening to
The Hop Podcast with No Name.
What a dumb name.
It's so stupid. So we'll start.
We're going to start.
I normally say the episode that we're on when we start. But I don't know what this will be because we're recording it ahead of time. So,
which is very unusual for us, Matt, to be very clear that we.
No, don't say that. We're always.
The amount of proactive work that's gone into this recording is much higher than normal for us, at least.
But whatever it is, it's part two. Whatever episode ends up being, this is just part two of that series. And we have Eric and Ron back with us. And if you don't know who they are, Andy, how would we. Quick intro.
Yeah. Well, if you don't know who they are, then please do listen to the episode right before this so that you can hear about their origin story in this space and you can hear about who they are and you can get a sense of who we're talking to. But if you're just joining us right now, so we've got Eric with us. He's the former CEO of Aera Energy. And previously to that, he was a senior executive at Shell. And then we also have Ron with us. So he was the former EHS manager for Aera Energy under Eric, and he's the current EHS manager for Hess Corporation at one of their locations. So thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for joining us. And so last episode, what we talked about, what we were hoping to explore is how you all started to enter into this hop space, because you have a story that is powerful to tell. And it's a story that I think is useful for a lot of different people. One, I mean, Eric, you actually reached out and asked whether or not we had ideas on a place to tell this story because it's so important to you based on where you had been within your thought process of managing safety, the experiences you had, and where you now are in the thought process, wanting to share that with other people that might be in a senior executive position or be within, you know, any C-suite or in a CEO role. And then for the rest of us, right, that get to learn from you and sort of, I mean, wish that you were our CEO, right? That's sort of the mentality that I would have in listening to this, being able to hear what changed in your thought process. And Ron, you being able to sort of witness that, see it, and have your own thought process journey of changing, you know, from how you used to manage in the safety space to what it looks like for you now. Hearing both of those journeys side by side is actually incredibly helpful in creating a mental picture of how this type of change can happen at an organization. And hopefully people can see themselves in some part of this. They can see themselves in some part of the flow of the journeys that you're having. I think we left off with understanding, you know, Eric, you had a very pivotal event that led you to want to manage how you were seeing safety differently, the way that you were measuring safety differently. And so you knew that you wanted to make a change, but we left off with then how did you decide that hop was the change direction? Like, how did you learn about the concepts? How did they land with you at first? That piece of the story would be helpful to understand.
Great to be back with you and Matt talking about the subject. So as I mentioned last time, I had been working in field operations of some sort since roughly 2008. Okay. And in that period, ran assets with good, you know, total recordable case frequency, felt like we were on the right track. And then an incident would happen, which would either have an impact on somebody's life, you know, long-term implications, or unfortunately, a fatality. And I think those moments of really connecting to the team and the family, and of course the individuals, it caused me to ask myself as a leader, what is my role in that? What is my role to help people avoid these life-changing or unfortunately life-ending incidents in our industry? And so from that time, I took a number of roles within Shell of increasing scope, both onshore US, the Deepwater Gulf of Mexico exploration business, which after Macondo was very, and still remains especially safety sensitive. And so during that time, I continued to explore what is my role in being an outstanding safety leader. Mm. After that assignment, I took a role at the head office of Shell in broadening assignment, right? Where they took me out of these business line roles and I was given a role at the head of the function for a division of Shell, which looked after industrial safety for that whole division, you know, 30 or 40 gas plants around the world, thousands of people every day, and also in charge of net zero and the environment. So safety and environment. And I remember there was a time there where Shell's performance on fatalities were spiking, obviously in the wrong direction. And so a number of us were brought together by the executive team at Shell to basically divine a way forward and think about how could we do things differently. And it was really at that time, because of the excellence of some of the safety professionals that I learned from, that I became exposed to this new way of thinking. And it sounds so simple, but it actually is really quite transformational, this whole human performance concept. So let me unpack that a little bit. Yeah. If you'll just hang with me for a second. So I grew up thinking about safety through the lens of a guy named Paul O'Neill, who some of you know in safety world. So Paul was the Secretary of the Treasury for the U.S. Before that, he was the CEO of Alcoa, right? Big alumina producer. And I saw him speak once, and he said that something along the lines of truly great companies are marked by a world where people are never injured at work, are never injured at work. So my mindset was, okay, if never injured at work of any size is the objective, how do we drill down and focus on that? Well, we measure the number of injuries at work across all oil and gas companies across the world in the form of total recordable case frequency or something similar to that, which is basically an OSHA measurement of the frequency where somebody suffers an injury where they need medical treatment, okay? So that is the objective, is get that to zero. Okay.
Which seems simple, right? On paper, right? So we have a number and we know that the target of that number is zero.
Zero.
Is that number non-existent?
Zero. Yeah.
Okay. So you look at the trajectory of incidents over time in any business, and thankfully they have gone down significantly since like the 1980s as management systems came into place, as certain ways to protect people, hands and gloves and eye protection, these kinds of first order things had made a real difference, but then you saw a plateau, okay? And so the question I asked myself is how to break through that plateau? Well, if you unpack the numbers in a company like Shell, but I'm sure it's the same anywhere else, the highest frequency events that impact the number of recordables every year are hand injuries, slips, trips, and falls. Okay, so I did what a lot of other people do, which is to say, okay, let's really lean into central programs. How many companies have hands programs, which roll out to everybody? And the objective is to reconnect everybody with the moral case that we need to care about each other, care about our families, which means we need to use all of the equipment, follow all of the procedures. And if we do all of that, we will have zero.
All right. So let me see if I can recap this, Eric, and make sure that I've got this mental image straight. Right. So you grew up with this thought process, right? This is the thought process that had been taught to you about how to manage safety, of our goal is zero injury of any type. And in looking to achieve that goal, we should be looking at the things that we're frequently seeing as problems, which in this case, right, we can take any of our data that we have available to us and say, okay, we've got hand injuries that seem to be problems, right? We've got slips, trips, and falls. And then we try to aggressively manage those types of injuries, usually using something that is trying to help the end user and the people around them create a mental image around the morality of safety, specifically to make sure that we are executing procedures and requirements, PPE requirements, mind on task, hazard analysis, to the T, to whatever we've written down, how the documentation we have in place that is supposed to then get us to the ability to not have those types of injuries happening. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's 100% right. That's the world I grew up in. And I would say that it's a familiar thing that many leaders, you know, I started working in the industry around the turn of the century. So I've been in it now for, 25 years. I think many leaders of my generation have experienced the same mindset, the same culture. So the analogy I would make for you, Andy and Matt, is, you know, I think about costs, right? And I think about the big stack of costs I have in a field. I'll break out those costs and figure out where are the most significant costs. You can think about ordering them on a bar chart in your mind. Mm-hmm. And you go after the biggest bar first. Because if you can make just a little bit of a change on that biggest bar, then your total aggregate cost is going to have the biggest impact. So, you know, my simple mind said, do the same thing on safety. Break apart the bar of all the incidents we have, go after the biggest bar, which, like I said, for the assets I was working in, tended to be hands, slips, trips, and falls. So a huge amount of energy gets put into that, programs reinforced by leaders like myself, going to the field and talking about how much we care about this, how we want people to take their time, how we want them to speak up, speak out, recognizing, but then also when incidents happen, putting energy into accountability about inevitably why didn't somebody follow the right process or put on their goggles or wear the right hand coverings for the job. And so that's kind of the mindset, is go after the biggest thing, make the biggest difference you can, put in place these processes, hold people accountable, and then have a moral and care part of the safety leadership narrative. Those are kind of the three things that I spent my time on. And so when
Eric, quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I'm hearing, you know, spending a lot of time and energy on hands and slip, trips, and falls. Were you just maximum conviction that that was going to be the change? Like, did the people hearing this feel the same way? Would they feel like you were onto something? Or was it like, I kind of know what else to focus on? Like, where did that fall in level of conviction for you?
I think that's a great question for Ron, actually, as a safety manager. I mean, I'm curious what you think when we make those bar charts and see the focus areas. I mean, does that feel like, aha, we're onto something, this is the right thing, and go down that path?
It's such a good question, and my answer would depend on what decade you're asking it in, right? And whether it was before or after HOP and SIF prevention, because I have done I spent the first 15 years living in the Pareto. I worked at an aluminum smelter where most of the leaders were disciples of Paul O'Neill. So I absolutely, you know, believed in zero. I absolutely was fully, you know, Heinrich's triangle was the thing. Domino theory was the mode of failure. And we just need to find the one domino to that would prevent the stack from falling all the way to the end, or even later the whole Swiss cheese model. So I would have said, I've spent a lot of time on hands. I've spent a lot of time and energy focused on, you know, backs and shoulders early on in my career. And I would say over the last 10 years, it's been more focused on trying to understand what our high consequence activities are, what the critical barriers need to be, and what are the health of them, and is that good enough? And what part of our process is really creating safety at the job site, and what part of our EHS systems are creating complexity that have little, no, or even negative value? That's how I would answer that question today.
Ron, what you're describing and what Eric just described in terms of, you know, bar charts or pie graphs of places that we want to focus our efforts, I distinctively remember, I can tell you what the room looked like in a strategy session where I was representing one of the regions that we were doing business in, and somebody put up on the screen what our metrics were around injuries, and hand injuries were in the largest bucket. And I remember them looking at me and saying, we need to be reducing our hand injuries. That's our goal for next year. And they gave me some percentage to reduce it. And they said, what's your plan? And I distinctively remember looking back at them and saying, if I knew how to do that, it would have been done already. Just this idea of, we're focusing so much attention on these hand injuries. You're telling me what the goal is. And I promise you, if it was that simple, if we knew how to do that, it would have been done already. And in the back of my mind thinking, this can't be what we should be focusing our time on. But at this point in my own journey, I didn't know what you just described, Ron. Like, I didn't know the alternative yet. All I knew is that something felt incredibly wrong about how much time and energy we were spending on the same types of solution sets for the same thing year in and year out, and not seeing progress, and then still being one of the people that was called when something very, very serious happened, being like, man, but I just spent a really long time putting together those hand posters that we just sent to everyone. I'm not sure that's where I should have been spending my time and my resources. All right, so Eric, you painted this picture of what the before was, and Ron, you've painted a before and a shift to an after. So then, Eric, what's the rest of the after story? Like, how did what you said you got some exposure to some of these concepts through some really good EHS leadership around you, but can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I read some of Todd Conklin's stuff. Very good and transformed me in the way I was thinking and a number of others. And I think the most shocking and simple idea. And so let me paint it this way. So I remember going into a room a little bit later, I'm skipping ahead a bit, but it'll make the point of imagine a room full of operators. Okay. Let's say 200. And I raise my hand in the front. I say, okay, how many of you believe that all incidents can be prevented? I remember distinctly about 90% of the room raise their hand. Because that's the orthodoxy. That's the mindset.
That's what you, yep.
If we do more, and if we try more, and if we are just better, we will have zero. Mm-hmm. And then I asked, how many of you in this room are perfect? Obviously, nobody in the room raised their hand, right? And the fact is, and I remember this was something Conklin said, and I'm going to paraphrase, it might not be exactly this, but he said something along the lines of, people, processes, and equipment are never perfect, which makes all the sense in the world. But here's the thing. Is that once you believe that statement is true, which I think is self-evident, our philosophy on safety, everything behind it changes. Because if you believe that it's impossible for our people, our processes, and our equipment to be perfect 100% of the time, that means that incidents will happen. And so by that measure, TRCF of zero is not possible. Like, my hands are up, which, like my head exploding.
Right,
that is like a head exploding moment, because it goes so far against the orthodoxy I grew up in for 20 years.
Yeah. Eric, I remember I entered in my organization as an intern, right? So I hadn't gone to school for safety. I'd gone to school for chemical engineering. I'm in my, must have been my junior year, and I'm interning in the summer, so between my junior and senior year. And I happened to intern within the environmental health and safety regional office. Actually, it was the business office at the time. And so that's, so I'm there with all of the senior EHS people in a space that I have never been before. And I remember an incident happened, and one of the people in these senior roles looked at me and said, do you believe all accidents are preventable? And I said, well, no, because that's why they're called accidents. And he looked at me and he said, "You're going to have to change that thought process if you ever want to get a real job here."
Wow.
And I was like, "Oh, okay, get on board real quick. I got it. Understand, yeah. This is the doctrine, right? This is the thought process." But what's interesting then is that, as you mentioned in the last podcast and you're describing now, it is the difference in the thought process itself that then starts to adjust what you would be spending your time and energy trying to manage, right? If we believe that the goal is perfect, right? Perfection, and we're just going to strive towards the idea of trying to get our equipment and our processes and our people to be perfect. Well, then you spend all your time and energy trying to achieve that goal, which, of course, we make progress in making things better, but then all of our time and energy is there and we never actually achieve the goal of whatever we deem perfect to look like, when you can actually acknowledge the fact that that isn't true. No matter how hard we try, humans are fallible, equipment degrades over time, processes can never be fully controlled at all moments of every type of variable that's going to be thrown at it. When we accept that that's true, then the philosophy of how to manage starts to shift. And obviously someone 100%. In your position who has some amount of control over resourcing and where everyone's turned their head to be looking at it, your philosophy is then going to influence a lot of people's philosophy within an organization, including Ron's, as he mentioned last time, right? So,
but was that, yeah. Let me
just expand on that by saying two things. One is, I think if I were talking to another C-suite executive across the table at lunch or whatever and went through this thought process, they would say, of course, people aren't perfect. I don't think it really hits you until you say, okay, what do I do with that? So there were two major ahas that came out the backside of that realization. This was over a span of weeks, whatever. The first realization was that incidents will occur. My role as an executive is to set the expectation that our job is to make sure that when an incident occurs, that it does not escalate into a life-changing injury or a major spill. I think this exists with spills as well. So it becomes a job of barrier health and prevention of escalation versus saying that we're going to get to zero incidents of all kinds. That was the first major realization, and there's implications of that as well. The second thing that really hit me, and this is an important one, is as much as we know that safety is a top priority, there are not infinite resources in any business. And we are always trying to put our resources to use in the best place. The second major aha for me was that we have been focusing on the wrong thing for years. We've been focusing on the wrong thing for years because I'll take hand incidents. I don't want anybody that works in my business to have a hand injury. But I'll tell you what, if there's a bump or a bruise or even a broken bone, that will sadden me for sure. However, if somebody's life's changed, they lose use of an arm. They lose an arm altogether. Or worse yet, they have a fatality. That's what keeps me up at night. And what I realized was with the limited, because everything's limited in the real world, the limited resources we have for what we pay attention to when it comes to safety, we have been focusing on the wrong thing. Because a safety incident with a hand can almost never escalate to a life-changing, life-ending injury. And it's through working with people like Ron that helped me unpack that even further and figure out what to do with it that was the major thing. But like, as soon as that simple concept of we're imperfect, our people's processes, equipment are imperfect, it manifested to me into two realizations. One is that we're focused on the wrong thing, and that we have got to make a significant change to really make progress and keep people safe.
This is such a, I have a very important question in my mind, at least, because this is such a profound change from where you were, which is like zero is possible, to this shift in thought. And I think a lot of people are sitting here listening, and maybe they're already there at the point where they know they want to make a change, but their CEO or even their leader is not. So what would you say to, like, what could have been brought to you to help you maybe hear that change faster or quicker? Or is that even possible? Did you have to get there by yourself? Like, what would that be like to someone who wants to go and influence that thought process change to their leader? And maybe this is for Ron and for Eric too, because I'm sure both are going through this at different times.
Well, I invite Ron to go there first, because I think your view is really instructive. I'm sure me coming in, it's not the first time you thought about how to approach this, but I'd be curious what your thoughts are, and then I'll maybe add on to it.
Yeah, so take a crack at it. I think the question is to other senior leaders and organizations who prioritize EHS improvement and performance is, do you want systems that are reliable? Do you want systems that are resilient? Do you, you know, what is it? Do you feel at times frustrated with the outcomes of work? And if so, there's this way of thinking that can transform an organization so that you can build resiliency, you can build reliability into your EHS processes. I know myself, I felt at times where it's a bit like whack-a-mole event. You know, you're going from RCFA to RCFA to a period where it feels like we have safety performance excellence, and only then to get, you know, have an event that really could have changed someone's life. And so if you're tired of that, focusing and reacting to all that business, then there is a path forward that emphasizes a lot of the things that we already believe in, you know, continuous improvement, systems thinking, simplification of our EHS processes and systems so that people learn quickly, that, you know, helps leaders with their engagement effectiveness. And it has a lot to do with these five principles. And so sitting down with an Andy or a Todd or a Bob Edwards or a group of experts that have been down this road for a period of time has certainly been helpful for me. Being influenced by Eric has changed my professional direction as well. So if that could help others, I that's what I would say to that question. I don't know, Eric, would you add to that?
Yeah, let me build on two thoughts there, Ron. I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of kind of Eric 1.0 versus Eric 2.0, where I'm sitting now.
Yeah. Okay, so what would I have had to say to you, Eric 1.0?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If somebody had come to me, I think there's two things that would change, that would get my attention. One is you have to have a beliefs conversation, because fundamentally there's a framework with which me as an executive, I look through safety. And what I've just talked about around accepting that incidents will happen, our job is to make sure they don't escalate. That is a foundational belief kind of conversation. And so I think for us to make any progress with another executive, a C-suite who is deciding whether to go down this path or not, there has to be some time set aside to really go to the fundamentals and have that conversation, reconnect with that last safety incident that changed somebody's life and their business. And, you know, C-suite executives are humans too. That impacts us. We think about that. Reconnecting with that moment, and as Ron said, the frustration that despite the additional resources and time and energy, we haven't made progress, reconnecting with that feeling and that frustration, and then going into engaging in that beliefs conversation is foundational. So that's number one. The second thing I would say is this doesn't have to blow up the way we work. the systems, the processes, the continuous improvement, the engagement with staff in the field, all of that stuff is set up to facilitate an execution of a different way of thinking and doing. So what we may do will change within the framework, but the framework itself stays. So worries about disruption or even cost, if those come into the conversation, I think we can allay those by talking, like Ron was saying, about how this can fit within the existing systems and structures that we have with some adjustment. Mm. I think that would help me as a leader. And then maybe let me just add this point, that once you're in that conversation or through that conversation, a good plan, an achievable plan to begin the first execution steps would need to come shortly after that conversation. Yeah.
So you would need to have someone be able to help illuminate the belief system that you're using to manage right now, right? Be able to have open conversation about that. Tie that then in some way to something that has emotion attached to it, whether that be frustration of throwing resources at something and not seeing change, or whether that be the real emotional pain that we feel when someone that works within our organization goes through some sort of life-changing event, and how we feel for them and for their family. But then also making sure that that's paired with a plan that doesn't feel not achievable, meaning that we're not saying that to do this, then the amount of resourcing we have to put into the safety space is, you know, quadrupled over the next, you know, quarter. What we're saying is, hey, we can use the existing mechanisms that we have, right? We already go into the field. We already, you know, have places where people are interacting with each other. We already have audits that are happening. We can just take those bits that we already do and adjust the philosophy we're using to achieve that interaction. And in adjusting that philosophy, we're not actually changing the mechanism, but we are changing the intent. We're changing the intent of the interaction, and therefore the outcome of the interaction is different, but the mechanism itself in most places already exists. It's a matter of tweaking it, not of reinventing something or throwing everything out and scrapping it and starting over.
And to that end, so yes, I agree with everything you said, and maybe this is the exclamation point on the end of the sentence.
Yeah,
tell us. People like me that are out there listening, through a number of initiatives and improvement, we actually reduced the cost of our centralized safety groups and budget over the same time period that we had a 60% reduction in life-changing injury events. Mm. So to the contrary, it didn't cost us more. It cost us less because of efficiencies the team brought in. And we had a step change in the safety we had in the field. To me, that is the exclamation point. This doesn't mean that it's going to cost a mint in order to make a sizable and transformative change in the safety of people that work in our business. That's the bottom line.
Can I add one thing to that sentiment?
A second exclamation point. Another one. Boom, point. Boom.
Yeah. So one of my own personal struggles in managing environmental health and safety programs is, you know, we have events, we learn, we adjust, we add more layers of protection over time, and we're really reluctant to remove anything because in our heart we believe it, there's a place for it, there's a reason it existed, and to remove it seems counterintuitive, and it almost feels a bit risky, a bit irresponsible,
almost amoral, because we don't even know. Ron. Like, I mean, it immoral. Can get to a place of feeling, well, if we remove that, it's amoral because that is clearly there to save someone's life, and removing it is a horrible thing, right? It gets mixed into a feeling of ultimate responsibility and morality.
That's right, and for those that are involved in the decision to remove some piece of an existing system, you know, it takes a bit of courage. And what I found in our evolution towards human and organizational performance and going to the sharp end of the spear, the worker, you know, to help understand what part of the system is really creating safety at the job site and what part is not. That piece of the puzzle that we didn't have before just took a huge weight off of my shoulders when I made the decision to take a layer or two away. And it actually simplified work. It reduced downtime because of the complexity of the administrative processes. And so it created capacity to perform work. It simplified the expectations so they were more understandable. So that was another component of this that I thought was important. It optimized our, it helped create an avenue so we could optimize our EHS processes.
Mm. Well said, Ron. So we had two exclamation points, which was...
Two great exclamation points.
So I think what we'd love to explore the next time that we're together is, so we've gotten a pretty good mental picture of kind of what started the desire to change. We have a pretty good mental picture of the philosophical aspect of what did change in terms of what we would be managing to, how we're picturing what is important to pay attention to. And then what I think would be really helpful for folks is understanding some of the nitty-gritty details of what it means to actually make that change, up into including, you know, the ways that you had to communicate across an entire organization. Because there's oftentimes, if you change, for example, from something of, hey, our goal is zero injuries, and suddenly that's not the message that we're saying all the time, oftentimes similar to what Ron just said, of it feels as though morally there must be something wrong with that. Are we now saying it's okay to be injured, and how do people receive those communications? Those are some of the barriers that people are confronted with when they're in a position in a senior executive role where they are the face of the change, right? They are the face of the philosophical switch. They're the ones that are talking to it, and how is it perceived by others? So learning about those nitty-gritty details, I think, would be really valuable for folks.
All right. Awesome. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Well, that's it.
Yep. Another one in the books. We did it.
If you want to send us any of your thoughts, actually fling us any of your thoughts, you can do so at the website www.hoppodcast.com.
That's hoppodcast.com.
It's still such a stupid name.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.